Medical Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital Tralee, celebrating 100 years of advanced medicine and exceptional care.
Dr. Eamon Shanahan, you're very welcome to the programme.
Amy, it's a glorious day.
Absolutely stunning. I hope you're getting to enjoy some of it.
That's last. I'll do it this evening when I get finished.
Same as myself. Looking here, looking inside of four walls of a studio. Yeah, yeah. But look, we could be in worse places.
Absolutely.
So we're discussing general matters here today, general queries on medical matters today, Dr. Eamon. So I'll get to it. Will I ask crack on there?
Crack on,
so my first question for you is coming in from a female in her early 30s. What would the cause be for a recurrent UTI, two in the space of 3 months, and is there anything to prevent them from happening?
Good question. An interesting topic. The recently retired professor of general practice in Trinity College in Dublin, Professor Tom O'Dowd, who is an extremely experienced general practitioner, wrote a book about this probably 20 years ago when he was working in the UK. It's probably gone out of print at this stage. I suppose the point that's been made is that there's many reasons why people, but specifically women, can have recurring urinary tract infections. There are a number of suggestions, and I think there are a number of theories, but I'm not sure if there's any sort of great proof of these either. One of the theories is just that the distance between the outside and the outside of the skin to the inside of the bladder is shorter in women than it is in men, and that may be part of the reason. I know that one of the things that the urologists, the specialists in this area, look at is just general hygiene down there. For example, wiping from the front to the back, maybe double voiding, passing urine twice, go to the toilet, do a wee, and then go back or do another wee, ensuring plenty of fluid intake. I think really the problem is that we're not really sure. Interestingly, in the age group that our listener is in, fortunately, that's not a problem, probably, that we would see in a number of older women. And one of the problems you see in older women is a condition called atrophic vaginitis, a condition where the tissues down below get drier because of a lack of estrogen at the time of the change. And that can lead to a loss of the stretchiness or the elasticity of the tissues, which can lead to infections getting back up inside. I think the other thing that could be suggested as well too is post-coital micturition, that after coitus to pass urine to clear the bladder out. So these are a number of suggestions. I would suggest, as ever, one of the really good websites that you can go to is patient.co.uk or patient.info, and there is, if you look there under the topic of recurring urinary tract infections, there'll be a number of practical suggestions.
She says she's currently taking BioCult probiotic tablets to counteract the Keflex antibiotics.
Yeah, and that's a fair point. Now, I mean, and that's actually an interesting point in itself, because the difficulty is that if we use the broad spectrum antibiotics. Now, again, and it's publicly accessible as a website called antibioticprescribing.ie. It's actually a HSE website, so I'll repeat that, antibioticprescribing.ie. And if you look at the section, there's a section of that about guidance for health professionals. You'll see that unless the person is allergic to the first-line antibiotics, and the first front-line antibiotics are a thing called nitrofurantoin and trimethoprim. They're the ones that we would prefer to start with. These are narrow-spectrum antibiotics. They tend not to cause upset. The more broad-spectrum antibiotics like Keflexin, but especially my betamar, using things like comoxiclav, that's sold under a variety of trade names, but one of them is Augmentin. Problem with those, they kill every bug that the person has, good and bad, and it actually paradoxically makes the person prone to more infections. So we would prefer to use nitrofurantoin or trimethoprim if possible, because they are specific to the bladder only, or must tend to treat the bladder only, and are less likely to run into other problems from the overuse of antibiotics.
Okay, now we've another question in from a male in his mid-40s. He's on medication for blood pressure, also taking Eliquis 2.5 and a natural aspirin. Or is it neutral aspirin? I'm not sure.
Neutral aspirin. Yeah, that's right.
Aspirin. Yeah. He's recurring bloodshot eyes. Is this something he should be concerned about?
Okay, there's a couple of things there that are quite interesting. Firstly, that our listener is in his 40s, isn't that correct?
Yeah, mid-40s.
Okay, so the thing is that the medication, the Eliquis, the generic name for that is apixaban. And apixaban is one of the newer what are called oral anticoagulant drugs. These are drugs that are intended to stop blood clotting. Aspirin also has an effect on the on clotting ability, as it's it reduces a thing called platelet stickiness. Anyway, the thing is that that combination is only used in very specific circumstances because of the bleeding risk that comes from both drugs independently, and then more so when it's taken together. Yes, it is probably fair to say that the bloodshot eyes are probably as a result of taking these medications, though I would be wary that if there's any suggestion whatsoever of any issues with the eyes themselves, any difficulty with blurring in the vision or anything like that, I would get the person should go and get themselves checked out sooner rather than later. Again, I've no doubt that there are specific special reasons for using these two medications. What tends to be the case is that you use one or the other, and occasionally you would use both, but only for a short period of time.
Okay, we have a couple of COVID questions in here. Dr. Eamon, lady aged in her 70s. She'd COVID a few weeks ago. No symptoms except stiffness in her muscles and her arms and legs. GP prescribed steroids and she still has stiffness. Is this long COVID?
Yeah. Okay, an interesting point. My friend and colleague, Dr. Maurice Houston, wrote about this in their Times yesterday. He was talking about what he called mid-COVID. And the idea behind that is that technically long COVID doesn't kick in until you've sort of had the condition for, I don't know, is it 3 months or 6 months or something like that. And Marisha was making the point, Dr. Marisha was making the point that there are people who have symptoms in the immediate aftermath, and we do recognise the fact that people can have symptoms for 3 months and more immediately after COVID. So is this long COVID? We don't know. See, part of the problem is we don't actually know what long COVID is. We know it happens. We can identify the symptoms of long COVID. We don't know why it happens in certain individuals. As well as one of the pieces of emerging evidence is that the more often you get COVID, the more likely it is you get COVID. And another statistic is that about 1 in 6 people will have some form of long-term symptoms, be it for a couple of weeks or a couple of months, but sometimes for longer after COVID. It's not a benign or an innocent illness, folks. Anyway, the thing is that the symptoms that are there certainly are due to the recent infection. However, if there's any doubts, what you do is give your GP a ring and have a chat for them.
Sticking with COVID now, a male in North Kerry, age 69, is testing positive for 9 days and is isolating. Does he still have to isolate as he's no symptoms at all?
No. I mean, and do me a favour, stop testing. Now, I know, Joe Biden has kind of screwed the pooch in this respect, in the sense that he had COVID, then he didn't have COVID, and then he had COVID again. The general consensus amongst the public health specialists is that from the time you test positive for COVID, and if your antigen test turns positive, then you definitely have COVID. Typically, after 10 days to 2 weeks, you will no longer be infectious. And after that length of time, you can pretty well go about your business. Now, I am saying, and I'm making no apologies to this for this fact, that particularly as you get into the winter months, but even now, for everybody, when we are congregating in places such as shops and so on and so forth, we should still be wearing masks. And for people who have had a recent COVID infection, it is prudent for them to wear masks to reduce the risk to others. But the thing is that the person stops shedding the virus after typically 10 days and definitely by 14 days. The test may remain positive. The test may detect traces of the virus in your system for quite a while afterwards, but you yourself are no longer contagious.
Okay. Can you ask Dr. Shanahan, I have middle ear infection on waiting list for ear, nose and throat specialist. Antibiotics didn't help, or ear drops. Anything else that could help while I'm waiting?
Yeah, not particularly, unfortunately. I mean, it'd probably be worthwhile talking to your chemist about trying to get nasal decongestant, something to try to free your nose. Now, the rationale for that is that the middle ear is connected by two little tubes. Each middle ear is connected by two little tubes to the back of the nose. They're called the eustachian tubes. And if you decongest the nose, if you reduce the congestion in the nose, it may allow for drainage from the middle ear. It may allow whatever fluids present in the middle ear to drain out. The problem is that for some individuals, the fluid that's produced in the middle ears kind of congeals and gets into kind of a sticky mass, and then all the decongestioning of the nose won't relieve it. And unfortunately for some individuals, the only way you can relieve this thing is by having a procedure called a meningotomy, where under local anaesthetic, a small incision is made in the eardrum, and the stuff that's inside the middle ear is then suctioned out. But try the decongestant and speak to your chemist about that.
Okay, so hi, would Dr. Eamon recommend surgery to remove bunions? We have a few legs and feet related queries. Can the procedure be carried out in a general hospital? I've one on both of my feet on my right foot. My big toe crosses over.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, the difficulty is that what are bunions? Bunions, strictly speaking, the bunion is the lumpy part of your foot on the inside of your big toes. But the problem is that the big toe itself has deviated out to the outside, is going across, and as our listener said, is actually crossing the other toes. And this is something that happens over the years and over the decades. Normally what will happen is that as we walk along, there's a tendon that runs under the ball of our foot right out to the tip of the toe and pulls the big toe backwards. And that's actually the main thing that propels us forward, is when we push off with our big toe. The trouble is that for some individuals, either because of hereditary reasons, though it was the case, but hopefully it's no longer the case, that people wearing shoes that were too tight, that push the toes across sideways. But what happens then is that because of a mechanical thing, if the toe starts to go off sideways, the tendon, instead of pulling off the tip of the toe and pulling it straight back, is actually pulling the toe sideways. And over time, the dang thing can cross over the toes. And that can be not only just very painful, it also interferes with the person's ability to get around. For some individuals in this situation, yes, there is surgery. It is done by orthopaedic surgeons, and there are orthopaedic surgeons who do nothing else or do spend most of their time just looking after bunions. It could be done in a general hospital, but it would need to be done by an orthopaedic surgeon who is experienced in this area. It's not something I think a general orthopaedic surgeon would do, I think.
Okay. This one is very suitable, I think, for this week, Dr. Eamon. I find it very hard to sleep. The nights are so warm. Help me, I can't open the windows. I'm not sure if that's because... I actually heard Joanna Donnelly from Met Éireann advising people this morning not to open the windows, to keep the hot air out, unless it's related to that.
Yeah, and again, but I think the other bit of that is pull curtains and blinds. Mm-hmm. So what you're talking about there is trying to keep the inside of your house as cool as possible. And that means that throughout the day, and you say, oh, jippers, these lovely days when you want to see the sunlight coming in. But the problem is that the sunlight comes in and so too does the heat. So if it's possible to pull curtains and blinds, if you can't open your window for some reason, then at least try and pull curtains and blinds. I think one of the problems that people have is that with these so-called roof lights, Velux lights and things like Velux windows and things like that, if they don't have shutters on them, then you get lots of heat or lots of light and heat streaming in, and the place becomes uncomfortable. I think that could I make a kind of a pragmatic middle suggestion? If you can't open the windows by night, at least could you try opening something during the later evening, just to cool the building down before you go to bed?
Okay, very good. This one now I can relate to a bit. A female in her 70s has what's like a mouth ulcer in the back of her mouth coming and going for the last year. It's not terribly sore, but what could it be?
Okay, I suppose straight away the question I'd ask is our listener a smoker or not? Now, obviously, we don't know the answer to that. The reason I'm saying that is because if you're a smoker and if you've got a persistent ulcer in your mouth, that's a source of concern, because it may be a growth of some sort, in which case you will need to see you'll need to see your GP, who will almost certainly refer to a specialist to get that thing checked out. If you're a never smoker or a long, long time non-smoker, it's more likely that you've got an aphthous ulcer, which is an uncomfortable and sore dose. There used to be great stuff years ago called Adcortil and Orbase, which was brilliant for these kind of ulcers. These days, we don't have access to that. There are a number of other treatments that can be used. Best thing to do about that is talk to your GP about it. Let them have a look at the back of your throat till they see what the nature of the lesion is, and then advise you accordingly.
Just full disclaimer, I don't smoke, but I do get a lot of mouth ulcers.
They're sore dose.
Lady in her 50s has cholesterol over 7. Would you recommend statins or diet?
Please stop focusing on one figure only. I've been talking about this for a long time. What's your HDL cholesterol? What's your family history? Are you a diabetic? Are you a smoker? Do you have high blood pressure? What's your weight? These are the things you need to look at, and not to be looking at total cholesterol of 7 only. You may or may not benefit from a statin. Now, to be fair, you can drive your total cholesterol up if you have a really bad diet, kind of steak for dinner and chop for tea kind of job. Nobody does that anymore, mercifully and thankfully. So as that, for most people, unless they're being completely daft about their diet altogether and eating far too much fat saturated foods, you're not going to drive up your cholesterol. The problem is conversely, even if you go on a very abstemious diet, now, okay, fair enough, if you go on one of these very elemental diets, you may be able to bring your cholesterol down, but genuinely you're looking at a diet that's so restrictive and so severe that you can't live with the darn thing. If you are at risk of heart disease, so for example, if there's a family history of premature heart disease, by premature I mean somebody having a heart attack or angina under the age of 60, if you're a diabetic, if you're a smoker, if you've got high blood pressure, yes, you may need to get your cholesterol down. And in those cases, the effective way of doing it is to take a statin. And there are a number of people for whom statins, unfortunately, are the only way to go. For many people, though, if you look at all the other risk factors, if you can adjust those, you may not end up needing to have to take a statin.
Very briefly, before we just go to a break, it's related to this as well. Does red rice yeast work for cholesterol?
The honest answer is I don't know. Okay. I just genuinely don't know the answer to that one. Answer is I don't know.
No problem. We'll take a quick break there, but Dr. Eamon will be with us after the break.
Medical Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital Tralee, celebrating 100 years of advanced medicine and exceptional care.
And you're very welcome back. We're here with Dr. Eamon Shanahan for Medical Matters, and we're taking all queries general. So we're going to move on now to another query. Dr. Eamon, Deirdre, this is obviously sent in to Deirdre, but I'm reading it out. Can you ask the doctor, please? I have laryngitis for over a month now. Is improved, but still not gone. I work in hospitality, so do a lot of talking. Should I get it checked out?
Yeah, probably a good idea to get it checked out. Now, again, I'm a bit like a stuck record again in this respect. If our listener has been in hospitality for a long period of time, even if they're never a smoker in the pre-smoking ban days, they would have been exposed to a lot of secondary smoke. The more likely thing, though, is that the person has a vocal strain, and so in that respect, or vocal cord strain, there are a number of things you could do. Yes, an ear, nose and throat specialist would probably be able to help you, because, okay, look, the main advantage of seeing an ear, nose and throat specialist is that they can give you appropriate assurance. They will have the little mirrors and cameras and things that can check out your vocal cords and make sure they're okay. Sometimes people who do a lot of talking get these little nodules or growths, benign growths. They're not cancerous growths, but they can get these benign growths in the vocal cords. And sometimes, unfortunately, the only way you can relieve the problem is by resting the voice. I know that professional singers often get professional advice in terms of how to protect their vocal cords, because obviously their career depends on them having functioning vocal cords, and I suspect the same thing pertains in our listener's case.
Yeah, absolutely. I find it myself, even just from being on air, like the honey and lemon even is just such a godsend.
That's what you're talking about, yeah.
Just maintenance, I suppose. I'm a woman of 53 and would appreciate any help on this matter. Can you ask the doctor if you could explain lipedema? I've been diagnosed with it, but need advice.
Yeah, is it lipedema? Yeah, funny enough, I think we actually addressed this last week, but let me just repeat it again. Lipedema is where there's a collection of fat under the surface of the skin. Now, the thing is that it's for most people it's a cosmetic problem, because it's a very unsightly thing. There is a related but different condition called lymphedema, and lymphedema is a condition where you get a build up of fluid in the tissues. Generally, what you do with that is you look what's the underlying cause of the buildup of fluid, and you try to take that away. Lipedema, on the other hand, is a buildup of fat tissue under the skin, and a lot more troublesome. The difficulty is that now it can be related to weight, and it can sometimes help to just be very careful about diet, and by reducing the number of fat cells in your body, it might help improve the situation. But unfortunately, what tends to be the case is that you remove fat from those parts of your body where it doesn't really make a huge difference, and you don't remove it from where you want it, typically in the legs, and it can make, you know, it's the unsightliness of it. Very, very occasionally, and I'm not something, it's not something I would generally recommend, but very occasionally there would be need for, sometimes people will resort to liposuction to try and relieve this problem.
Okay, this is an interesting one, and maybe you can relate with a lot of people. I just need to ask the doctor, I have to get up at least 6 times at night to wee. I try to stop taking fluids at around 7 in the evening, but it doesn't matter. Female of 60 years, no problem during the day, only when she lies down.
Yeah, I strongly suspect our poor listener has this condition I referred to earlier on called atrophic vaginitis. You need to see a colleague, probably a female colleague, and they need to have a look at you down below. They need to examine the vulva and so on. I strongly suspect that what the problem is that our poor listener has got this condition called atrophic vaginitis, where the tissues become dried. Now, the thing is, there's a very effective treatment for that. There are a number of local estrogen preparations. I'm well aware of the fact that the pendulum in terms of The acceptance of and recommendation of general hormone replacement therapy has swung back from the position it was in, say, 20 years ago. But at the same time, you don't necessarily have to take what they call systemic hormone replacement therapy. You don't have to take a hormone replacement therapy tablet to relieve this. There are a number of hormone replacement treatments for the vagina that can be dramatically effective. I mean, as in life-alteringly, brilliantly good. So it's well worth your while talking to a colleague or to one of my female colleagues. Get them to have a look at you down below and take it from there.
Okay, I'm not familiar with what this lady's trying to say here, but you might understand the references, Dr. Eamon. Could you ask the doctor why I'm getting ABC mottled appearance on my arms and legs? I'm in my late 70s, female, it comes and goes, thanks.
Okay, so Erthema Bigna is the name for it. It was thought at one stage to be due to heat damage. The classic one was that you'd see the rash appearing on the legs and people who were sitting by fires, and they'd get this particular mottling of their skin just because of the heat of the fire. Now, there are some unfortunates who do get this rash in other parts of the body. The difficulty is, okay, quick answer is I don't know, because it depends on the person's particular individual circumstances. I do know that in terms of diagnosis, what probably ends up happening is that the person will need to see a dermatologist, who in turn will do a skin biopsy, will take a sample of tissue of the skin, send that away for analysis, work out what the actual problem is, and then provide the appropriate treatment. The reason I'm saying that and using that particular course of action is that there are a variety of creams and things you could use which might or might not help, which is one problem, and secondly may or may not cause harm, which is another problem. The thing is, by doing the skin biopsy, you work out why exactly the person has the problem, so that the specific correct treatment can be applied.
Okay, we've a couple of sun-related queries, so I'd like to get to those, because obviously everyone can probably relate to them. But there's an OAP in Killarney wants to know, how much water should we be drinking in the heat? She drinks from a 500 milliliter bottle.
Yeah, again, it's adequate fluid. Now, adequate fluid, even in this weather, you're probably talking about 2.5 to 3 litres at most. Okay, insensible loss is about 500 mils a day. So 500 millilitres, a half litre, is the amount of fluid we lose through our skin every day as we live and breathe. Add another litre to that for the normal turnover. So a sort of 1.5 litres a day is probably sufficient. If you are sweating excessively, you may need to take extra fluids. But unless you're absolutely sweating buckets, you probably don't need to take large amounts of extra fluids. And one of the problems and one of the things to be aware of is that if you are doing a lot of sweating as well as fluid, you're losing salts from your body. So is that if you are unfortunate enough to be sweating profusely, it actually might be of benefit to use something like dioralite or something like that. Foul stuff and all as it is like drinking seawater, but it replaces the salts that you're losing from your body as well as the fluids.
Okay, another sun-related one then. Can you please ask Dr. Shanahan if you can put sun cream on an eight-month-old baby? I'm keeping him out of the sun, but if we were walking, it would be extra protection in this weather.
Yeah, yes, you can. There are, I'm quite certain, if you talk to a chemist, I'm quite certain that there are some sun preparations you can use for the babies. But I think the more sensible course of action is just keep the child out of the direct sunlight. And there are ways and means of doing that. There are buggies, there are sun parasols on buggies. You can use long sleeve clothes. One of the things actually in that respect is that from as early as the child will tolerate you doing it, get them to wear sunglasses. Even at that age, it's appropriate, because but also you need to make sure the sunglasses actually block ultraviolet light, because the thing is, what you want to do is you don't want excessive exposure to the baby's eyes to ultraviolet light, which could cause damage to the lenses in the eyes that would lead to cataracts later in life.
And this is an interesting one, Dr. Eamon. A lady in her 50s, I think it's 50s, there might be a misprint here, it's either 50s or 40s, has a burning sensation in her leg near her ankle that moves up her leg and then gets very cold.
Yeah, sounds like a neuralgia of some sort. Sounds like it's a nerve pain. Now, that would indicate that there's something putting pressure on the nerve to that particular part of the body. She'll have to see somebody about that to get that sorted out.
Okay. Is there a quick cure for pulled ligaments? I've them 2 weeks now on my right foot. I think I know the answer to this one.
No, but the answer is talk to a physio. Talk to a physio, because they'll do the work for you. The difficulty when you pull ligaments is that you lose a thing called proprioception, which is a kind of a sixth sense that allows us to orientate our body in space around us. And the thing is, what our physio colleagues are really good at doing is identifying which of the particular ligaments or tendons or muscles indeed are damaged, and then applying the appropriate therapies to relieve that. So the best thing to do is talk to a physio.
This is one I often wonder myself, actually. Does sciatica come and go, and what's the best way to treat it?
Yeah, the answer is sciatica does come and go. Sciatica is pressure that's being applied to the sciatic nerve. So the sciatic nerve is a nerve that comes out of the lower part of the spine, the lumbar spine, is it 4, 5 and 6, something like that, and they get bundled together and they form this nerve that goes, it's sort of a over the buttock, moves around to the outside of the leg, goes down on the outside of the knee, and then goes all the way down the outside of the foot out to the little toe. And if there's pressure put on that nerve somewhere along the track, but typically at the spine, the level of the spine, then that'll cause the pain that people experience with sciatica. Even if you did nothing, most of these things do go away. Most sciatic problems are back-related problems, and in the majority of cases, again, physiotherapy can be extremely useful at helping to offload pressure off the nerve and take and relieve pain that way. Now, there are other treatments that can be used for sciatica as necessary, but even if you did nothing at all, probably 95% of the time sciatic pain goes away of its own accord eventually.
Okay. Please ask Dr. Eamon to discuss temporal arthritis. Is it an autoimmune disease?
Yes, it is, and it's something you need to be careful of.
Is all arthritis autoimmune diseases?
Not necessarily. No. Osteoarthritis is more wear and tear, even though there's a bit of debate about that. Rheumatoid arthritis is a connective tissue disorder. The thing is, and an autoimmune disease, the thing is temporal, T-E-M-P-O-R-A-L, it's an arteritis, A-R-T-E-R-I-T-I-S, it's an inflammation of the artery on the side of your temple. The significance of this is that there's a branch of that artery called the retinal artery. It goes into the back of the eye. If you have a temporal arthritis, if you have an invasion of the artery in the temple, there is a risk that it could clot itself off, block itself off, which is a problem enough in its own right. But the difficulty is that if it blocks off the retinal artery, you get loss of vision, you get loss of blood supply to the back of the eye. And like brain tissue, unless the cells at the back of the eye are receiving a constant supply of blood, they will die within a matter of 2 or 3 minutes. And unfortunately, that's a cause of permanent and irreversible blindness. So as that if somebody has temporal arthritis, there are simple blood tests your GPs can do. And then we put people on high doses of steroids to try to reduce inflammation.
Okay. I'm a 58-year-old woman. I'm having breakthrough bleeding. It's more like a period. Happened at 5:30 a.m. Had to take 2 paracetamol at 8:30 for pain this morning. I'm on HRT for the past 3 years and I started the menopause at 53. What could be the problem?
Yeah, I suppose breakthrough bleeding is a nuisance. The only thing is that technically any bleeding after the menopause is postmenopausal bleeding. That there may be something else going on. Best thing to do is talk to your own GP about that, because they'll need to check you out. Basically, they'll need to check you out down below to make sure there's nothing else going on. But beyond that, I'd be guessing. I'd prefer not to comment, because there are a number of things that might cause it. It's important to get it checked out, though.
Okay, I'm a lady in my late 40s and I have plantar fasciitis. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. For the last year, very painful. I've gotten shock therapy, 6 sessions done, but it only helped a little and as painful as ever again. Would Dr. Eamon recommend an injection or any other suggestions? And she says, I'm not overweight.
Yeah, fair enough, yeah. No, injections are useful, but they're extremely painful. The idea there is that you inject an anti-inflammatory into the place where this thing called the plantar fascia is attached to the bone under our heel. It's a sheet of tissue that runs from the front of the heel bone of the calcaneus back to the back of the toes, and it imparts the springiness in our foot. It's a mechanical problem, and something has caused, it's an obvious injury, it's a strain of that particular ligament, and it's an extremely uncomfortable dose, because you're walking around like as if you're walking on glass. It's horrible dose. It's a mechanical problem. The lithotripsy, the shockwave treatment, is to try to reduce the spur of bone you can get with this thing. Steroid therapy can be useful as well too, but steroid therapy is extremely uncomfortable as a therapy, and that's the reason why most practitioners don't do it these days. It is about supporting the foot. It has to do with biomechanics. It has to do with how the way in which the foot works. It'd probably be a case of talking to an orthopaedic surgeon, and maybe even an orthopaedic surgeon with a specific interest in this area, to try and get this thing sorted out, given that's been going on this length of time.
Okay, we might just take one more then before we let you go, Dr. Eamon. My husband, aged 61, has a constant frog in his throat for the past 2.5 months and got COVID at the start of March. Also has a wheeze in his chest from time to time. Has reflux diagnosed with Barrett's esophagus 2 years ago and was wondering if this could be related.
Yeah, well, if the Barrett's esophagus is there, I'm just wondering, is he taking the relevant medication? So from a group of drugs called the proton pump inhibitors, these are drugs that suppress acid production and are important for people who've got Barrett's esophagus, to ensure that it doesn't progress into anything else. The reason I'm saying that is that if our listener is taking their proton pump inhibitor regularly, then I'd be looking at the throat itself in case there's anything there. If they're not taking the proton pump inhibitor, I'd suggest going back on it in the first instance and see if that helps the situation.
Dr. Eamon Shanahan, thank you very much for joining
You're
us on the programme.
We'll have
Eamon back again, so make sure you do get your queries in, and apologies if we didn't get to all of them. They were flying in today. We'll take a quick break there.